Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Gather Round. Tonight we have a guest host along with me, Ruthanna Marte Feel, Michael Staples, who has the show coming on at 9 o'clock, and he's so graciously consented to get in with us now.
We're going Good evening, to talk everyone. With
we're going to talk with people from the Peace House in Washington, D.C. And to start tonight, the band from the Peace House called Where is Calvin and Rob going to start us out.
So this is Rock the Beat, an original song of ours.
Like it all, you like it all. Life is easy, not so complicated. Like the band, you like the party. Take my number, let's get started. I know we like to drink some wine. I know we like to lose our mind. I know we like to shake it all. I know we like to drink some wine. I know we like to lose our mind. I know we like to take it all. I know, drop the beat, tonight's still young, we're just having fun. Vicious is this climb towards my way. I know we do it all, working all day. So when the light falls, not to life, I only escape. And then the drink lies, the party open. Love is so cheesy, she came to play, yeah. I know we do it all, working all day. So when the light falls, not to life, I only escape. And then the drink lies, the party open. Love is so cheesy, she came to play. So drop the beat,
guys are here. I know that the Peace House sort of nurtures all types of art, and this is the first time that we've had any on. Riha, some time ago, was the first person who ever told me about Peace House. I mean, if I had ever seen anything about it before, it just didn't click in my mind. And so we've interviewed a couple people from there before. This is the first time that she's consented to come on. So thank you.
We wanted to say thank you for having us before and for giving us another chance to speak.
Oh, well, it's such a good, I don't want to just say cause, but it's such a good thing you're doing. And I know that you all believe in it. Would one of you just give us a little history on Peace House and also on the Peace Vigil?
Okay.
And for our listeners, you can find this information at OccupyPeaceHouse.org.
Right, or you can find us on Facebook under the Peace House, and you will see it's the one in Washington, D.C. Just to give you a quick background about the history, basically William Thomas, who started out with Proposition 1 in Washington, D.C., the anti-nuclear peace vigil in front of the White House, They started in the year 1981. They also established what is called the Peace Vigil, which is the longest existing peace vigil in the world. It's one of a kind. It's very unique. It has a grandfathered right in to be in front of the White House and spread the message of peace and, you know, raise awareness what nuclear weapons, nuclear war can create. And it's a perfect spot, basically. You receive people from around the world. You get the chance to spread the message onto them. And sometimes people don't understand the effectiveness of this because it's so simple. People have a I believe because it's so simple. People don't understand that something so simple could have greater effects because you start out within people. You spread the message of peace. Very simple. You spread the message of love. And he unfortunately passed away in 2009. Connie, or as we call her, Connie or Concepcion, she had joined him a little after he started the peace vigil, and she's still with us. She has been doing this peace vigil since, which is now almost 32 years. And the Peace House, we are a group of community organizers, student activists, and musicians, and art can be a great tool as well to reach out to your community and to do activism work. So we all came together basically after we heard, we had received this message that the house was facing financial problems. It was going to get sold. We knew that it was very important for us to step in to try to save this place, because we knew the importance of the history. We knew that this is something very unique. We wanted to move into the house. We wanted to, we wanted to keep the history alive, but we also wanted to bring something new, bring it onto the next level.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we have been doing for the past 9 months, going to be around almost 10 months by now. We moved in. We started out. It was very hard because we had so many ideas, but we didn't know for sure what to do first. It took us a little bit of time until we figured out where we wanted to go, and now we have an amazing project, and which is called Love, Music, Hate, Racism. We're very, very happy about this. We're very proud, and It's a project we adapted from England and Ireland. It was started out there. It's been running there for over 10 years, very successfully. Started out because of increasing racism coming from the BNP, the British National Party, towards what you want to call, you know, the brown people. You know, they're the target over there, like the Pakistanis or the Indians.
Right, yeah.
They started this project, stepping into the footsteps. What was really big in the 70s, love, rock, hate, racism. So we seen it, you know, being a tool between the community, a community outreach tool, basically opening up space for the community to have a way of addressing their issues, their concerns. And those people don't really have many opportunities to do that. So this was exactly what we have been looking for, something that we could do, we have fun with, but something that people also could associate with. We want to be inclusive. We want to be the people's embassy, and this is a great way of becoming a better people's embassy by projects where we can to the community and where we can bring something so beautiful such as music to address an issue which is so ugly such as racism.
Well, now, tell me, I know that there was quite a bit of concern because you had to raise $300,000 for the house. How is that going, or has it been pushed back, or the deadline, or how is that?
Unfortunately, we haven't fixed that problem yet, and that is very sad. But we're still not down. We're still
right.
Not giving. What has been happening since the last time someone from the Peace House has been talking to you guys? With this project, we finally had the chance where the other organizations and other like-minded people finally came to us and said, we want to partner with you. And
I saw that. on the page, that you had partners now. Yeah.
Which is great, because those people, we have a lot of things in common, and it's good to work together with people that see things the way you do,
right.
And then we have the common goals of certain things. It makes life a little bit easier. You struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So hopefully, my point here is, through those organizations, and one of them recently joined us, the People's Media Center, they're really huge. And so we hope through these organizations, maybe we will have more arms to reach out to, where you know, they will spread the message about the Peace House. And hopefully, through a miracle, we will still be able to save this place.
Right. Because now this house is a little distant from where you hold the Peace Vigil.
Yeah.
Isn't it? But it holds quite a few people. How many residents are there now?
We have around 20 residents, but with Hurricane being here, Hurricane Sandy being here, we put around 48 people here. Those were all activists who came into town for a certain action, or supporting the actions of the veterans in front of the Department of Veterans Affairs. So we had a lot of activists. Washington, D.C., you know, they were just outside and they were caught in the hurricane. So we put them in here, and that was a huge challenge, because very limited resources. This house is beautiful but yet old, so we have leaks here and there sometimes. And so with the hurricane being here, with very little resources, you know, you still had to put a smile on your face, and you had to figure out how to do what we do the best way.
Right, and to stretch the soup, right?
Yes.
So tell me, how did you and how did Mira, how did the band even hear about Peace House?
When I was involved with Occupy, I heard about Connie first, and somebody came to me and said, well, I'm doing volunteer work for Connie. I'm relieving her sometimes, but I'm going to be leaving town soon, and she needs more help, and she's getting older. So I have started. I'm trying to reach out to Connie with a couple of other people. And Mira, she's my best friend.
Right.
When she, basically, people were like, well, we're going to move into the Peace House. There were like two or three people that wanted to move into the Peace House, and I was still living in College Park, going to University of Maryland, and Mira was doing her thing with the Right for Education for Palestine, where she was doing tours around the country, and people kept on asking me to move in and Mira to move in, but right around that time, Mira was about to go back home. So I had talked to her. We were kind of like, what shall we do? And we were kind of confident, as soon as you see the Peace House, you just feel, you know, something very magical, peaceful, something, you know, you want to be part of. And I was asked to be just coming in here to try to raise funds and create events and do more like media outreach. And then I saw that it was, you know, it was getting to a point of where I felt like my help was so needed that I decided to give up my place, move into the Peace House, and I started doing creating events, and we had great events. I had Egyptian revolutionary leaders here. We had university professors here. Like recently, we had Dr. Mubarak Awad. He is he's the founder of Nonviolence International. So we had great, great people here. So, but later on, we kind of were put in a position of we had to more step up. We had to be the house managers. I say we had to, but it sounds negative, but it's not negative. I mean, I'm happy here, and I'm happy that I have this opportunity. It's a learning progress for everybody. But we became basically the house managers. And at one of our fundraisers, which was at Madam's Organ, and Madam's Organ is located in Adams, Oregon, they have a nonprofit day. we were doing, you know, a little bit of outreach, trying to raise some funds. We had these beautiful boys basically walk in, and they were like, we are homeless musicians. We give up our home because we have a passion. It's music, and we would like to play for you. And first, I was a little confused about it, and I was like, sure, you know, go ahead, play music. And we didn't know what we were going to expect, but then they stepped onto the stage, and they had their guitars, and they had their music, and everybody was right away amazed because they're very talented. And we had, again, something in common with Calvin and Rob, because we come from a position of where we gave up our lives to be here, and for them, you know, giving up their life, you know, while they're very young, giving up their life for something that they love so much. So we all had a passion for something. And when people come together with so much passion for something, then the only thing you do is you create something more beautiful.
Right. So, but I would say that you didn't give up your life. You changed your life.
Right,
much
right.
More, because this is definitely your life, and it seems that at this point in time, this is what you're all supposed to be doing. But I wanted to ask Mira a couple questions.
Sure.
Can she hear me?
Yes.
Mira, what does your family in Palestine think about all of this? You living with a bunch of people in a peace house.
Well, my parents and I actually have a really good relationship. They really support the work I'm doing. I get a lot of support from my father, who has always been an academic, and when I was 13, he handed me Marx on Economics and English and said, read this.
Okay, then. You're very fortunate that way, yeah.
I was very fortunate. So my father was the man who always said to me, you know, greatness is never given to you, you know, you make yourself great, so I'm living in peace and working in peace communes in Ireland for the past 5 years, actually. And then I moved to the United States and started doing this. So it's a beautiful, beautiful, challenging sort of reality to be in, because the cultures change and the people change, but the causes and the issues wherever you go remain the same. Whether they're colonialism, whether they're imperialism and capitalism, they are the things that are destroying the lives of ordinary people who are trying to make a living in this world, or trying to stay above water, while the rich and the wealthy and the one percenters, as they call them, remain very happy in their glass castles. And
yeah.
So a part of the things that me and my family, I come from a very political Palestinian family, and we find that your best sword is your tongue and your pen to tell the world your story. So, you know, this is how they feel. You know, they scared every once in a while. Of course, everyone was going crazy about Hurricane Sandy, and my parents were like, oh, do you have enough food? Okay. Do you have a warm jacket? Okay. We will talk to you next week.
Yeah.
So it's good. They're very supportive. It's kind of great.
Oh, it's very good that they're supportive. What about the guys and Calvin and Rob? Are they handy? Are they nearby? I just want to ask them about their music.
Oh, they are amazing. Would you like to have a few words with them?
Right, please. Yeah.
Hello.
Okay, amazing guys. I just wanted a couple questions. You were all playing together before you found Peace House, but how did you hear about it?
We quit our jobs because we were working for corporate jobs and just jobs that really don't really, they were a waste of time because we weren't practicing our craft, it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
So Robert, one day I was about to go, I missed work and I was about to still go back for the $8 an hour. And Robert was like, Calvin, you can't go, we got to focus on our craft. So I listened to him. And I trusted my best friend Robert, so we decided to not. I decided not to go back, and he quit his job that day. And then we just we were living in Reston, and then we've been moving a lot, but we moved to Washington D.C. And then we were just homeless for like about 3 weeks, in the streets of D.C., and it was pretty rough, but we had our spirits up. And then we were walking at Mams, Oregon, because somebody in the street told us that we were wasting our time where we were at one spot that we were trying out to pay for money.
Oh.
So they told us to go to Adams Morgan, from area in Washington, D.C. So we head over there, and we recognized the name of the bar. We were like, maybe there's, I remembered they do an open mic, so we wanted to stop by. And then they lead us to us just playing up, you know, for the Peace House for a fundraiser. And then they heard our story, and they took us in.
Oh, okay. What do your families say about you quitting your ridiculous, not going anywhere corporate job and ending up in a peace community?
Well, at first, you know, they were very concerned because, you know, people do that. They think they're just, you know, kind of
losing their life. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, you know, but then we have a Facebook page where we post all of our progress, videos, music we record. And, you know, over time they started seeing how much we've developed our art since they've last, you know, got to hear us for themselves. And then they started realizing, like, that we're actually really taking this serious, and it's not just an act of, you know, laziness, you know. It's just, you know, we're actually wanting to devote, you know, all of our time to just building up this, you know, the art and being able to respectively give it back to the people to appreciate it and to carry on with, you know, what we can give back to them. So, you know, they always, everything we post, they're constantly on our Facebook page sharing our stuff, because now they're really proud of us, and, you know, they're very supportive and really come to appreciate, you know, a radical decision that we made. But, you know, now they're seeing our vision, how we saw it, you know, before they could understand it. Now they, you know, they get the reality, and now they're really, like, rooting for us every day, and, you know, we keep in touch with them.
And that's it. What is your Facebook called, your page?
It's facebook.com/whereiscalvinandrob.
Okay, where is Calvin and Rob, that's it. Okay, for people just joining us, we're talking with residents of Peace House in Washington, D.C. The Facebook page for them is The Peace House, and the band, Facebook page again, is Where is Calvin and Rob. So, Michael, do you have a couple questions before I continue?
Yeah, I have a question. Can they tell us a little bit about some of the other organizations that they've been able to partner with for the work that they do?
Well, we would like to pass you back to Free and Mira for that.
Okay, guys, thank you very much. We really enjoy your music.
Okay, One of our partner organization is this beautiful group called Stand for Art. You can check them out under standforart.org. They started out in California, and they relocated in D.C. We met them at one of, like, a street fair, and we started to talk to them. And they basically wanted to create a platform for artists and just for artists, either by displaying art or finding venues for artists. They had also this beautiful idea of, you know, founding something called Liquid IQ. Liquid IQ is basically water that was meditated upon, based on the theory that if you meditate on water or speak nice words by water, near water, the water molecules turn into positive molecules.
Dr. Emoto.
Yeah.
Japanese man.
Right,
I am constantly in awe every time I pick up one of his books. I'm sorry, go ahead, but I understand really where you're coming from. Yeah.
it's beautiful, and that water is basically, it came out of that theory. It's called Liquid IQ, and what they did is for everybody, if you buy a bottle of water, which is $2, half of the money goes towards saving the Peace House. The next group is the Looking Glass or / Envision Radio. Again, it's it's a group that wants to create some sort of platform for artists coming from the media area, and they have a beautiful radio show with Olivia Fox. She's very famous within the DC area, and the other organization is called the Electric Mate. Electric Mate, they like to consider themselves the community living room. They do a lot of open mics. They do yoga classes. You know, they give their space basically to people, and so they have been there for around, I believe, 12 years exactly. And last but not least, the People's Media Center. And the People's Media Center does a lot with like providing resources for different kind of artwork, media artwork, theater, music, everything. And they also provide teach-ins for people who would like to learn more. And yeah, that's so far, that's what it is.
That sounds fantastic. It's amazing that you all are working with so many innovative and interesting groups. Can you talk about a little bit about any of the projects you either have, you know, recently completed or that are in the pipeline?
Right. I'd like to let Mira just talk a little bit about Love Music, Hate Racism, and then I can talk about other things. There you go.
Terrific.
Hey guys, so first of all, happy Halloween. I don't think we said that.
No, yes, happy. Yes, we're walking tonight.
It's lovely. Everybody's out in Georgia, in what's the name of that area? Georgetown, and all over, people are celebrating. But it has a zombie, so she looks kind of scary, but, you know, you don't see her, so it's kind of better that way, because nobody really wants to talk to a zombie. Or they... Anyway, Love Music, Hate Racism actually came together. It was formulating, we were working on finding something that actually unites us with our community for so long, because we worked with the Occupy movement for so long, supported the Occupy, but our role within our community wasn't so strong, our relationship with our neighbors. And we kept on thinking, and up until actually Rob and Calvin joined us, that Love Music Hate Racism started to form properly. We had our first show at Best Boys and Poets, and we had amazing musicians within them, Omega, Leftist, Where's Love and Calvin, a wonderful young lady with an angel's voice called Natalia, and it was a Dirty Girl, amazing musicians. And our project, which is now one of our main projects, it's basically a way to communicate with people beyond looking at their race, but actually attacking and fighting the topics that divide us through communication, whether it be musical, whether it be poetry, whether it be art, and whether it be community conversation. So we work on all issues. We have two main upcoming events, which is Poets of Protest is one of our new groups, which anybody who is an amazing poet can come up, can bring their poetry to us, and we will present it. And the other part is, the other sort of event is Storytellers. And Love Music Hate Racism presents both. And Storytellers, we had our first event, and basically was people coming on stage, whether using music, whether using folk stories, they told their story. And slowly but surely, people from the audience started coming up, signing their names, getting on stage and telling their story. And we have found that using music and art is the best way to communicate with people, because people don't want to hear the same old jazz about what racism is and how to fight it. But if you bring that to the table using entertainment and using a language that everybody speaks, whether it be music, whether it be poetry, then you're a winner, because you are connecting with the people who don't want to be too political, or who don't want to be too, you know, too academic, but rather everybody. We're attempting here in D.C., and hopefully this spreads more, to give a platform for the poor and the marginalized and the people who were discriminated against to have a real platform. We do not
We do not dub anything. We do not tell people not what to say. Whatever you have, you come to any stage of Love Music Hate Racism and say it. And one way or another, we found that the rooms that we filled with audience were always filled with love and understanding. So Love Music Hate Racism is a huge project. At the moment,
it's very powerful, isn't it?
It's very powerful. It's very powerful because a lot of people came to us and said, isn't the hate racism harsh? Shouldn't we use something like love music creates unity? And, you know, our response was like, no, because racism is not gone. We have to attack it with the same way and the same way it attacks others. So,
Michael, do you have anything like that out in California?
No, but I'm kind of speechless because I am so impressed with the work that they're doing, and I love that there's a real focus on building community and doing it in such a way that, you know, barriers like race and maybe even to some degree language are not so much a problem because people can communicate through the arts in a way that they can't necessarily communicate in the same way and on the same levels in, you know, direct language communications or even, you know, fear of communicating with somebody that, you know, they're afraid there's not going to be a connection to, but through music and the arts, they find connections. So I'm just very excited.
It sounds wonderful, doesn't it? I wanted to ask, I'm so glad that you guys have these partners now because this should take off even larger. I wanted to ask a couple questions about the actual peace vigil. Because this means that since 1981, someone, sometimes only one person, but someone has been manning this little piece of property across from the White House 24/7, right?
Yeah.
And many times it was Connie. I know that she is in her 70s, and she recently hurt her foot or leg, I believe.
Right. And... it has been maintained 24/7, even during the peak of Hurricane Sandy. I was actually one of those that went out there, and it was like I didn't know what to expect, but we knew that we had to go out there and we had to make sure that tent doesn't blow away. We secured it as much as we could, and I was very happy because two of my Peace House team members came, you know, help me because everybody knew it was going to get really hefty. So during that night, during the heart of the hurricane, we were actually three people and, you know, one was sitting to my left and one was sitting to my right and I was basically in the middle. And every time, you know, this hurricane was attacking, we were like, okay, it's coming. And then we were holding as much as we could. And it's sometimes interesting because you have these journalists coming up to you and you're just like freezing really and cold and you're absolutely wet and you're just trying to hold this tent together and then people are like, well, you're basically one of the only people out here and I have to make a report about the hurricane, so can I ask you a couple of questions? So it's like no matter what Mother Nature gives you, no matter what, how you feel, no matter, you know, what kind of day it is, somebody has to go out there and somebody has to make sure that piece of history will be kept alive.
Right. Well, now, I'm assuming that the people who make Peace House their home for whether short or long periods, most of them do stand vigil. But do other people who are just going to school and living elsewhere or not going to school, maybe working in the D.C. Mm-hmm. area, do they come down and take a shift?
Oh, yeah. Even students who don't live here, they do a shift here and there, or people who just, you know, have regular jobs, or
yeah.
Have people from the faith community sometimes, you know, they want to do a shift, or, yeah.
So, and you do have pamphlets or some type of information that you pass out. Now, this is made on site or by your artists anyway, right?
for the peace vigil, the information? That information is made by Connie herself. What our people sometimes do is we pitch in here and there a sign, but this is her thing, and she has her own handouts. In case you haven't seen it, she has it actually in many languages. You have German, English, you have Dutch, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, you have Italian, Spanish. So she usually has a box. She always prepares it herself still. Whenever the copies go low, she will tell one of us that she needs more copies. And it will be, there are handouts about the history, who she is, and how long she's been doing it. And there is a handout about nuclear weapons. And
But now, then at the vigil, the handouts you give, you don't give out anything about Peace House itself?
We don't, but we try to tell people because
we don't want to be
disrespectful towards the Peace Vigil, because the Peace Vigil is still the Peace Vigil. Yes,
right.
we cheer for it, but unless we have specific permission from her, we would feel as if we would, step into her Peace Vigil, or we interfere with it. So we usually, when people come to us, we say where she lives and what we do, and if they want to, we kind of guide them to either our Facebook or our website.
Okay, well, no, that makes sense. Because, right, you don't want to disrespect at all, because this is such a fabulous thing. You sometimes have, I believe, like groups of school kids and different organizations that come to the vigil, that you get a chance to talk to several people at once.
Right. Go on. Sorry.
No. Yeah. Go ahead.
You have my experience when I do the peace vigil is that people from. Let's put it that way. You have the biggest issue you will have is when you have very pro-Zionist visitors in front of the White House. They feel very attacked by, they call them anti-Semitic signs, or they don't quite understand.
Okay.
Yeah, those kind of visitors are the most intense ones. Other than that, it's really just people who will start talking to you. They want to know, why are you here? And they want to explain their point of view, and they want to, but the intense moments you really have with a certain group of, let's say, pro-Zionist believers, or even the tourist groups, sometimes you have, how you will know after you do the peace vigil for a while, you get to know each tourist guide, and most of them are very polite, most of them very nice, and they say hi to you, and it's funny because the lady that does it for the visitors from the state of Israel, she will be very aggressive, or she will,
Okay, yeah. Somehow that doesn't surprise me. But mostly you are treated very nicely then by the people who come with their questions and their comments.
I would say yes, fairly nicely, fairly polite. I haven't really experienced anything bad. Again, the most intense moments, and I'm trying to be polite about this,
yeah.
You have a group of Zionists there.
They seem, I just deal with them on Facebook, and they're pretty overbearing. So,
Just to get back to the other question, what other projects? We have our main project, Love Music Hate Racism, but we also are supporting the veterans who are doing Occupy in front of the Department of Veterans Affairs. Some of our PISO's members are those who started this specific cause, which is very important for them, because Bill, for example, who has been with Occupy, with the PISO for a very long time, he was one of the veterans who started occupying in front of the Department of Veterans Affairs, and he has right now you know, sometimes it just gets really worse where he has health issues still affecting Agent Orange. And so the group of veterans went there and wanted to have a conversation with a representative of the department. And they basically just wanted to talk about simple things like, what are you doing with the increasing rate of suicides of veterans, which is around 16 and 18 a day?
Right, which is absolutely horrible. That is disgraceful. Yeah.
What are you doing with the increasing number of homeless veterans? So these are basic questions, and these are men who, you know, who have fought in the Vietnam War and who, you know, so they were denied this conversation, and they have said until we actually see some progress, until we actually receive our questions being answered to a way where we can see that you're really trying hard, we will not, you know, stop occupying in front of the that's the
Veterans
thing.
Veterans Affairs building then.
And they're there all the time as well. A group of people, a group of veterans and people who want to support them, they go out there and they just sleep there. And they come back here and they, you know, sometimes you need to rest and where else you have to go besides the peace house, of course. They come here, they eat sometimes here, shower and go back to their cause.
So, yeah, that's marvelous that you're actually going there and helping and supporting when they come back to the peace house.
Right.
If somebody somewhere, I mean, they can't necessarily do peace house, like this has been in operation for quite a while and the vigil for 31 years, but if there's somebody in some other town where not much is happening as far as activism, what would you suggest for them to get something started? I mean, what a question, huh? It's wide open.
You know,
I was going to ask the same thing.
Okay, see, great mind.
You know, sometimes I want to tell these people, just run away. Don't do it.
Don't even think about it.
Yeah, it is very, very, it's not something like a regular job where you go and you work from, I don't know, from 8 a.m. in the morning and then you go home at 4. It's not like that. Especially what we're doing is not like that. You need to have a certain plan. Write it down. Write down why you want to do it. Write down your goals and put it in front of your eyes. And if you feel like that is really important for me and I really want to do this, it's inside of me, and you really, you know, you can't live without achieving this, then I say go for it. Do it no matter what. No matter what who tells you, no matter what you will lose, just do it. But make sure you have a group of people with you. You should never do anything on your own. Make sure you have people with you that will always be, in a way, loyal to you, in a way you always know that, you know, having Mira with me, no matter what, I always also have a friend next to me. You know, I can be mad next to her. I can be sad next to her. So it's very important that you don't do it with somebody that you absolutely don't know. That's really important. Make sure you have money on you, because you should not start anything without money. And I say this because it can be very difficult. It's difficult because you have to pay utilities, you have to, you know, pay rent, and especially when you start out new, you need a lot of time to reach out to people, you need a lot of time to explain yourself to people, you need a lot of time until people understand why it is so important, for, you know, that you are there. So that takes a lot of time. If people have the chance to start out with a financial backup, I would definitely suggest to do so, because that will make your life much easier. If you can, don't do it the way we do it. Don't live where you work. Always have, you know, a balance, a loophole where you can balance out yourself. It's very important for us. This works for us, by the way. I can't tell other people. You should always have a spiritual guidance within you, because that's what keeps us very alive. We sometimes when you get stressed out, everything gets really, you know, crazy. You need to have something spiritual inside of you that will keep you, you know, keep your insanity and don't make you go crazy. And
no, that, I mean, that holds for anything, just to find that balance and things and to be able to connect with something greater than yourself, or
right.
larger than yourself. Yeah. I can see that. But now, you have been an activist for how long? For real?
I started out, I believe around 3 years. I started out in upstate New York, Syracuse. I started out with the Syracuse Peace Center, and that's when I kind of like got to know people who have been doing this kind of work for a long time. You know, you have the people that have been active against the drones over there and have been
mm-hmm.
arrested and doing a lot of Palestine outreach and community outreach, great community outreach group up there. But I always wanted to come around this area, Washington, Maryland area, because I knew that there's a lot of organizations, a lot of groups, a lot of like-minded people, and I feel as if this is the place where you can actually need to make a change, because you
mm-hmm.
it is in D.C. You have all your corrupt politicians and right here. And so I wanted to be here, and this is why I transferred to University of Maryland, and I was like, this is where I want to be. And I was right with that, because even when you go to school around here, you have more kind of students with you who kind of think like you, but they have maybe a different cause. So I was my real activism, I believe, started out by being a member of Students for Justice in Palestine, and that's around that time when I also met Mira, who came to my school and gave a speech with other former students of Bruce State University, talking about their experience of how their life was as students in Palestine. And that's basically when I met her. And I remember when I met her, I was very excited, and I kept on raising my hand. I wanted to say something that I thought was really important, and I was so excited. And another thing that I was involved with was, of course, when I was doing volunteer work for the Free Palestine Movement, I was doing media coordination when I was asked by Paul Lerudy, who's really, you know, one of the forefathers of this, of working for peace and justice in Palestine. When I received that phone call and I was asked to do media outreach for the PAS flotillas, and that's when basically things really started becoming serious, because it was very important. I had a lot of responsibility. Sometimes I'm like, I don't know how to do this. And, and then I met beautiful, amazing people like Anne Wright, who I believe it was the first AIPAC action in D.C., move over AIPAC. And when I met her and I talked to her, and I had met her at a school speech before, she had just came back from the flotillas, and I was like, hi, I know you don't remember me. And so I started talking to her, and she said, no, I do remember you. And that's when I also met Rachel Corey's parents. And
Cindy and Craig, yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful. And so Anne Wright was like, most likely she stared at me as, okay, you crazy little Turk. And then she grabbed me by hands, and then she was like, I'm going to take you to Code Pink office, and you can help us make signs and make, you know. And that's when I got to get to know better Medea Benjamin, who's also on our advisory board, and all the crew from Code Pink. And so that's basically how I started out, and it's something that I always wanted to do, something like this. So I always wanted to organize. I always wanted to be a tool within people and spread some message and make a change. So definitely I'm doing what I always wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And your nationality is what?
Oh, I'm from Turkey.
You are from Turkey. Okay, when you said, young Turk, I didn't know if you were using that as an expression like we use, or if you meant you're really from Turkey. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm backing up a little bit. When you were talking about D.C., truly, and I've traveled around this country and a couple others, but in this country, I think the energy in D.C. is the most intense of any place that I've been. I think it's, yeah. So I can see why you would want to be there and know that you can really accomplish something because it is fantastic.
But
I mean, go ahead.
It's also the hardest city. it's when you're in New York, when you're in Chicago. I was in Chicago for the NATO actions, and I realized that there is more, you have a more and more openness of a certain group of people. There are more easier tools sometimes. You have a certain, you know, it's easier to reach out to a certain group of people in certain cities. In D.C., you have not only a lot of politicians, a lot of people that work for the government, you have a harder time to reach out and to establish yourself. It's like Hollywood for actors. And
yeah.
So that is really the hardest part. But a lot of people are telling us, you know, something like this is very unique. We have never seen before. You should not give up. You should continue doing it. And that's really important for us because, yeah.
Right. You need to hear that. But, you know, also D.C. is much, I mean, you're talking New York, which has, what, something like, I don't even know. I mean, 7-9 million something. Chicago's got, in the greater Chicago area, maybe 4-5 million. I mean, D.C.
Right.
is a small town compared to those.
That's
so
true.
You're not going to have as many of some types of advantages as others. But I am so sorry. Our time is really running out, and we want to hear Where is Calvin and Hobb one more time. So,
right.
Before they go, can they tell us really quickly, folks listening who want to help out Peace House, what we can do?
I hate to repeat myself, but anything counts. If you can just spare $1, $5, whatever it is, if you go to OccupyPeaceHouse.org, there is a small, cute little button, and I've made the website. So if you want to
You made the website? It's a very attractive website, actually.
I made the website. So if you press that little cute donate button, and whatever you can spare, we promise you we're not going out to buy shoes. We joke around sometimes. Like that. We put it back
Thank
into
you.
The And it, look at it as your as a social investment, as I always like to say. It's a social investment. You invest it to the community, into people that really try to make a change. So saying all that, I'm going to give it up to Rob and Calvin, and they hopefully finish up.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Marika.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Bye. Thank you. And Rob, and you can find them on Facebook page of the same name. For more about Peace House, it's www.occupypeacehouse.org. Also on Facebook, The Peace House. So, Farika, Mira, and Calvin and Rob, thank you all so much.
Thank you for having us. Thank you, Ruth.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
In the beginning of September, you'll find DaughtersOfIsis.com fully functional and waiting for you to go on over and make your purchases of any of our oils or our flower essence formulas or misters or powders, potions, and brews, because we've even got teas. That's the ancestor of aromacology over at DaughtersOfIsis.com. Thank you now for coming by to see us. We appreciate it.
Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of 30 Minutes. And this is a very special edition because tonight we are live, broadcasting live, and I'm waiting for your calls. You can call me tonight at area code 718-664-6436. For this special edition this evening, Happy Halloween, we are doing Stories of the Supernatural. Have you ever had an experience where you thought you might have seen a ghost or a UFO? Maybe you saw Bigfoot. Maybe you had a dream and it came true, or maybe it was something else. Any number of things could be considered supernatural, and if it's ever happened to you, we'd love to hear about it. So give us a call, 718-664-6436. I want to hear your stories. I'll tell you one of mine to start us off. This happened to me about 4 to 5 years ago. I was working in an herbalist shop in Melbourne, Florida. You've probably heard me talk about this place before, and in fact, I had interviewed the owner of the shop on the show, the second show about the herbalist. This was in the same place. We were working in the shop one day, and our friend Maria, who's very intuitive. Now, I'm going to condense this story because it could be much longer. But anyway, let's say that for a while, a number of occurrences have been happening at the store, not supernatural, not paranormal, just certain people coming by that were not really wanted around there. They were coming by with ill intent. And so for the longest time, we kept wondering, you know, what was attracting them? What were they looking for? Because, you know, the store didn't carry any kind of herbs that, you know, might be considered questionable or, you know, whatever that somebody could be using for any kind of nefarious purposes. They're just straight up regular medicinal herbs. But anyway, so these people kept coming and coming. One day, Maria says to Celia, who is the herbalist, the owner, you know, that
statue of St. Sophia. I'm getting a bad feeling about it. I think it needs to go. And so he was like, oh, no. That was given to me by somebody when I first opened the store. They told me never get rid of it. It's like good luck. And Maria's like, no, I'm having a bad feeling about this. So we got the statue down. We took a look at it. Celia thought about it, and she decides, okay, I can let it go. We can get rid of it. But Maria's like, no, you can't get rid of it. We have to actually destroy it. So we took it outside. We took a hammer to it, and we beat it to a pulp. This is where the story got interesting. Inside of the statue was another statue. The other statue was Baphomet, otherwise known as the devil. So it was very disturbing that inside of a St. Sophia statue was, it wasn't a statue, it was like a medallion with the face of Baphomet on it. I don't know what it meant. I don't know that it was bringing bad luck to the store, but I do know that once it was removed from the store, the people that Celia didn't really want coming around stopped coming around. I don't know. I can't say for sure why that happened that way, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. So I hope you have some stories to tell me tonight. It's Halloween. Give me a call, 718-664-6436. Anybody out there? Come on. There's got to be some folks out there who have nothing to do on Halloween night. So the children have done their trick-or-treating. People are home, getting into bed. You're listening to this show and you're thinking, oh, my God, I have that tale. I have to tell Michael. Give me a call, 718-664-6436. Nobody? Nobody has any more stories for me. Well, Ruthann, I know you're out there somewhere. Do you have a story you can share with us this evening?
I'm out here. Well, I'll try to condense it quite a bit, too. But years ago, I lived in Idaho, and I was on the eastern side, and I was driving back and forth from Pocatello, where I lived, to Idaho Falls, just a little over an hour or so, through what they call the rock. And this is lava rock from millenniums ago, and it's on both sides of the road. And I was opening up a store. I was hiring in, setting up a store in Idaho Falls. And one night, it was pretty late, and I was coming home, and my radio went out. And now this is a very lonely stretch of the road. And so the radio went out, and my headlights started dimming, and I was not thrilled. And all of a sudden, I was
not thrilled.
and I could tell, like, the car was just dying, and I was coasting. And I pulled over to the edge, and, you know, no lights, no radio, and I had just cleaned my car out, and I had taken my blankets in. Well, never do that. You know, it's sort of deserty kind of feeling. It's really cold at night. And I was thinking, okay, now I don't really want to stay and breathe. And this was in the warm weather, but at night it was cool.
Oh, right.
And I was looking around, and this is ranch country. It's not like little farms that are a few hundred acres, you know, where I live now, you can look out and you see lots of lights from the farm.
Right.
Here
right.
It wasn't the case.
You were in the middle of nowhere.
Really. On my right, I did see lights way over, and the same on the left. Like, that was just one here and one there. And it's like, okay, that's way too far to even think.
No.
I mean, you know, they're probably 10 miles away.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to be walking either. And besides, I was dressed like in business attire kind of thing. So it's
right.
Like, okay, freeze, stay in the car, what will I do? And all of a sudden, I heard footsteps on gravel, and I was like, how can anyone, you know, be out here? I mean, really, in the middle of nowhere, all of a sudden, my car was just filled with this energy, like all these spirits were there, And it was pretty much like, oh, party time, you know, pop the champagne. But but whatever they were doing, they just gave me that boost. I had never hitchhiked in my life, and knock on something, I don't plan on ever hitchhiking in my life. However,
right. Wow.
I thought, okay, you know, this is it. So I got out, and but before I really got out, I mean, I just was sort of getting out, and I was on the other side of the car, and blah, blah, like a semi went by. Then here came a car, and it went past me, and it got down there somehow, and they had seen me, and they backed up. And I was thinking, oh, God, it's, you know, what?
Right.
Well, it was three ladies who happened to be going to the town. They were going to Pocatello, where I live.
Oh, my God.
And like, they had slowly gone by me and then back up, but because they were also afraid.
Right.
Because, you know, it's very common. You put the woman out there, and then when some car stops, some guy comes rushing out with a gun or something.
It's disturbing how often that happens these days.
Yeah. So we had a nice talk, and they got me home. Remember, my brother, for instance, when we pulled up, every light in our house was on. We shared a house. And I walked in, and he started screaming at me. And he said, where have you been? And, you know, by then it's, I don't know, 1:30 in the morning. And he said, look at my arm. The hair on his arm was standing up. Because he worked second shift, and he had gotten home, and he said he knew something was wrong because all of my house spirits were gone.
Wow.
And, you know, so it was probably them, I just didn't recognize them in a different place, who had come.
Yeah.
So, you know, we went up there the next morning, the car started right up, and it was about 4 inches. If I would have gone 4 inches more to the right, I would have fallen off into.
Oh my God!
So it was really, one of those times. But the spirit saved me, you know, by giving me confidence to get out and catch a ride. So that, I mean, that's not like your typical ghost story, but for me, it's like, wow. I mean, it really.
That's a wonderful story. I love that.
It helped me. Recognize and acknowledge them. And so I never stopped working with them because it's like, okay, they were there for me. So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's one of those things you just never know.
Well, I don't know. I don't know myself about this evening. Goodness gracious. Well, I'll tell another story. Another story for me. Not too long ago, I was involved with a spiritualist church. Now, if you're not familiar with a spiritualist church, this is a church that believes and practices spirit communication and mediumship. They actually teach it in the church. And in a typical church service, if you ever go to a spiritualist church, it's almost eerily similar to a regular Protestant service in many ways. I mean, you sit in pews and there's a pastor and he might even wear a collar and he'll give a sermon. But at the end or at some part of the service, he'll start giving psychic readings to either a handful of people in the congregation or in some cases, depending on the size of the church, he might do everybody. Anyway, I went off on a tangent there. I'm actually, that's a little bit of background about the spiritualist church. But
that's
so I'm taking, what's that?
I said, that's good to know. I did not know that.
They're a very fascinating group of people. And they're the ones that started those spiritualist communities like Lilydale outside of New York and Casadega down in Florida. And you can still go to those places today and get a psychic reading or a number of them. I mean, there's still, like, this community of spiritualists and psychics who live in these little towns. And, you know, they'll have, like, psychic fairs and community events and seances at Halloween and, you know, all the normal things to help keep money generated in the community. But anyway, so back to my story. I was taking a spiritual or a psychic development class through the Spiritualist Church in Florida. And I noticed that the longer I went with the class, I probably did it for about, I don't know, three to four months, something like that, and would meet weekly. And I noticed the further I went along in the class, in a sense, I don't know, it's almost like it exercised a psychic muscle in my spirit or my mind or whatever. And the stronger it got, the more the invisible world around me began to become more apparent to me. And it wasn't something I was seeking out. It wasn't even something I thought was going to happen. I was just kind of into it because I thought, you know, it'd be fun to take a class where you, like, practice, you know, giving each other readings or trying to pick up things on one another, whatever. But I did not realize, or I didn't even think about how doing that kind of work on a regular basis might affect me in other ways. So one evening, I am in my house in Florida, and it's late, and I think I was pretty sound asleep at the time when this occurred. And I'm in my room, the door shut, windows shut. I tend to sleep that way. I don't know why. I don't like things open around me. And I had this huge picture hanging behind me over my bed. And it was a really heavy photo. So I had this huge nail that was holding it up. And so I'm sitting there sound asleep. And then all of a sudden, right around 3-ish, 2:33 in the morning, boy, that picture came off the wall and slammed on the floor next to me. And I not only did I wake up and startle, and I think I yelled out quite loudly, I think loud enough for my neighbors to come over and, like, you know, I think they knocked on the wall or something. I had to say, I told them I had a nightmare. I wasn't ready to tell them that I may have had a visitation. But it was interesting that, like I said, the longer I was in this class, it was almost like they were saying, okay, you're opening yourself up to us. Now we're going to make ourselves known to you. And I think that's true. I think that's true for a lot of folks when they, you know, they begin playing around with, say, now I don't recommend this to anyone, but folks who start playing around with Ouija boards, people who practice meditation a lot, often find that over time, other faculties that they may not have been thinking about start to open up, and they start to become aware of more of the world or more of the universe.
Yeah, I think that's true. And sometimes you just sort of go into it so gradually that you don't realize that other people aren't having these experiences.
That's right.
And it's like, exactly. Wow, I mean, you don't feel this, you don't. And you can tell that they don't.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of people, even people that I think are even interested in it and want to believe in it, don't necessarily experience it. And that could be due to a lot of reasons. It could be, you know, where they're at spiritually. It could be other factors going on in their life. I think because someone has, you know, just because someone is drawn to that doesn't necessarily mean that right away they're going to have an experience of the supernatural mm-hmm. to sort of verify their belief. I mean, they may right. have to simply have faith for a long time before they actually have any kind of an experience.
Well, that's true. And just because we want something doesn't mean it happens. Now, like you, though, you opened up more because you were taking the class.
That's right, yes.
So that would be something people and, can do. I mean, like they say, everybody. They say everybody has the ability, or most people, but it's one of those.
I definitely believe everybody has the capacity, but that not everyone is going to do whatever, you know, was going to have the wherewithal to you know, if it doesn't come naturally to them, then, you know, consequently, that means you will have to work at it. And you really do have to work at it if you really want to develop that ability. It's not, a passing interest won't be enough.
Right. That's well said.
So anyway, you know, so that's really what it comes down to. But you know, we live in such a fascinating world and universe, and there, to me, there's so many very interesting and exciting things happening every day, all the time. And, you know, when there's certain factions of society who look on, let's say, things of the supernatural or things that are considered sci-fi, but, you know, we all know in 5 or 10 years will be, you know, more than a reality. You know, I just think it's just hard. It's inusable for me or for anyone else, I think, to, you know, sort of look down on anything they don't understand simply because they don't understand it.
Right. Because, well, Jay, I'd be looking down on a lot because while I know things exist, I don't know, like, I don't understand electricity.
Right.
I mean,
neither do they.
Really?
I don't understand it.
It's like, I may not understand energy, but I know how it works and I know how to work it. So, hey, you know, I have a silly tale for you if you want to talk a bit more about spirits.
Yes, definitely. We like all tales.
Well, years ago, I was part of a group and you know, in a small town in Illinois, we had a building, an old building, and I happened to be one of the people that lived upstairs in it. And it was sort of a commune kind of thing in a way. It's just a really old building with a bunch of quote-unquote spiritual people. And a lot were around, not too many lived there. And but this one time there was a big ritual plan. So a lot of people from many places had come for it. And, you know, we were all garbed up and we started out, we had a procession outside and then we came up the stairs to the big ritual space. And I had like a loft area over in one corner of the large area. But, you know, walking up in my robes and everything, and somebody passed me on the ass. And it's like, I thought, who the hell? And I turned and looked, and the next person down was like 9 steps behind me.
Oh, wow.
There was no one there.
No one that could be seen anyway.
Yeah, exactly. No one that could be seen. And so I just sort of snickered, and I thought, okay. I mean, because I know spirits have senses of humor. Let's get real. And it
That's
was,
right.
But it was, I was just so surprised. It just took me off guard.
Right.
You know, it's like, who's tapping me back? But I have found that they really do have that sense of craziness.
Mm-hmm.
And they will do things, you know, like when they hide things on you, and sometimes it's not us being absent-minded. No, they will hide things. But at that same location, my cats, and they do it where I live now. I mean, you know, animals do. They will look at a blank wall, and they're really seeing something.
They can see what we can't.
Exactly.
Damn them for having
And sometimes you can see they move and they move their head and they're watching. It's like, well, I want to see what you're seeing, kind of
That's
thing.
Right.
But
yeah.
In that space up there, they played with invisible to us people. Different people once in a while. You could hear a ball, and someone had seen a little girl up there and a cat. And we knew that my cat played with the cat that we couldn't see. So it was one of those places. It was old, like I said. And it had housed people back in the 1918s or 19s when they had that influenza in this country, the U.S.
Wow.
And so because it was right next to railroad tracks, And evidently, the story goes anyway, that, you know, they wouldn't have people on these trains, and when they got sick, they'd take them off. They had to put them somewhere. This building had a lot of tales from that. And then it had been a horse, not a stable, but, like a livery stable kind of thing. And it had gone through a lot of different things, and there was an apartment upstairs that people had lived in at one time at different ends than where I did. But that kind of thing, because it was old, it had a real history. But the spirits there were really...
And it sounds like a lot of people came through it for a lot of years.
Yeah.
You know, that building has had a lot of experience, so it would be surprising, actually, if there weren't anyone.
If there weren't. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine had set up a cot and sort of a little canopy thing, and she was staying up there occasionally. And when she was doing a little decorating, she had some help. She wanted to hang something on the wall, and she just didn't know. And she tried a couple places, and she distinctly heard them tell her no. And then she got to this one area, and they told her here. And she did.
Nice.
It's like you know, it's just best to go ahead with them. If you feel good about it, we should mention, though, that just because something is a spirit, it's not necessarily malevolent, and it's not necessarily beneficial. You have try them out, too. But,
you have to take authority, and you have to question them, and you have to... especially if it's activity in your own home, I think it depends. It probably depends a lot on the activity, but, you know, a lot of people live peacefully with spirits in their home, their whole lives, you know, and then other people, it's too intense and it needs to be dealt with, but people, you know, so often they want to, leave that to somebody else. You know, you come in, I'm going to hire someone to come in and take care of this for me, but the truth is that it's your home, and you, for a house cleansing of a, when you have a difficult spirit activity, the homeowner really needs to be involved in that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it's their experience, you know, and it's their home, and they need to take an active role in, you know, quote unquote, putting their foot down.
Right. And that's not to say that you shouldn't, if you really don't know what to do, or if you'd feel better having somebody else come and help, by all means do.
Definitely get help.
But
I'm saying that so often they want to remove themselves from the situation and let someone else fix it for me.
Exactly. Fix it for me. I'm going to go down to the cafe.
That's right.
3 blocks away. Come on down there when you're through, and we'll have coffee together, and then I'll go home. Like, no,
right.
No. You get in here and you go around ringing the bell too, kid. Or whatever you're going to do. But that's like anything, whether you're doing spells, which, and cleansing is a spell, actually.
Absolutely.
Anything like that.
A manipulation of energy.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about this being Halloween night, and tomorrow's the beginning of the new year.
Mm-hmm.
All of that, thinking about, you know, the kids, they don't trick-or-treat like they used to. I mean, I know I sound older than God, and I'm not really, but it seemed like
I remember back in the day when we used to go door-to-door and without a fear in the world. I mean, it was before, you know, kids could be snatched or find a needle in their apple or any other of the most ridiculous things that happen nowadays. Or when you had to, like, nowadays, you have to take your bag of candy to the doctor's office so we can x-ray it or anything dangerous. My God, what has happened?
Yeah.
No, I have seen the changes in my own lifetime.
Yeah. And some of the best part was actually getting homemade. Well, I'm such a sucker for popcorn balls, you know. I mean, getting homemade things, though, whether it was candy or cookies made, and you could just take what you wanted kind of thing, or maybe they'd wrap a couple together. But now, I mean, everybody's cautioned so much to
exactly
well, it has to be wrapped
that's, It's not like it has to be completely packaged and wrapped and maybe even have a label on it so they know it's from a legitimate source.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I swear I'm so cynical with good cause. I wouldn't be surprised because I did hear that the blade in the apple was an urban myth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So because that was a few years now, I remember, and there was something else, and they said it was an urban myth. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if the candy companies had something to do with that.
Yeah,
because,
it's like a red flag.
Mm-hmm. You know, because, okay, now everybody feels they've got to go out, buy packaged, prepackaged candy.
That's right. Which kids
don't need. And
exactly.
Now, you know, you're worrying about GMOs and everything. You give them a granola bar, and the oats are probably going to knock them out.
The good thing that's come out of the way that trick-or-treating has changed, now that it's sort of gone through this difficult period where kids didn't really know what to do, a lot of, you know, organizations have, like, parties where, or businesses, downtown businesses, shopping malls will have, like, a trick-or-treat time where kids can go to the stores and, you know, and get candies and gifts and things. So if nothing else, it's changed the way it's done, but it's almost like trick-or-treating is sort of finding its niche again.
Yeah, no, that's true, because people, just for the safety of the kids, they are planning these things. So
right. You're
right. It's not the same. That doesn't mean it's not as good. It's just changed.
What?
Yeah.
Well, the good thing is that with these, like a community party or something, the community then can, you know, they can take control over what the kids are getting. You know,
mm-hmm.
they can say, okay, this, for our trick-or-treating, we're only giving out, I don't know, low sugar, whatever, you know, fruit-based, you know, sweetened candies, whatever the choice is. But, you know, they have the ability to make those choices when you're planning something within a particular organization or within a small community.
Yeah, and that is good, because when it's just totally, well, and people who have different dietary, they make different choices for their families, so that there's things that they just wouldn't want their kids to get.
Exactly.
And, there was one of the vegan groups that I met. There had been quite a discussion on what to do with their kids, and because they don't want them eating the stuff that people will be giving them, and you know, it's just sort of like, okay, what do we do? And you know, the consensus really was, if you lived where there's a few other families, do like you were talking, the party with those.
Exactly.
Other kids, and you know, then you know what they can have as far as food wise, or cute little toys or whatever. So, the resilience of people and how they can do things is amazing. But
absolutely.
I'm sorry, I've talked away your show, Michael. And
that's okay. That's okay. You know, this was one of those weird nights. You know, but that's okay. Next time I have a live show, I'm just going to have to lasso my guests in to make those calls and get on the show. But no worries. We'll be back next week with another interesting show and somebody else to tell their story. So please come back.
Here we go. Your shows are excellent because you have such wonderful guests. So I always enjoy them.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for joining me tonight. And I hope everyone has a Happy Halloween, Blessed Samhain, or whatever you might be celebrating this evening.
Right, or tomorrow. All Saints and Day of the Dead and all of these things. Celtic New Year. So, happy holidays.
Happy holidays.